tower cases that the radio committee has been involved with. 13 tower cases, we did lose one. But it was an extremely unusual case where the person had done some things that really angered the living daylights out of his neighbors. And he did lose that case. But as I said, we've had 13 cases, we've had 12 wins, so I think we've got a reasonably good track record. Thank you for any further questions or comments, Bob.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I was by Tony's house last week, and yeah, he's got a real nice setup. Turned out real nice. Okay, thanks again, W2PNJ.
Okay, let's see, Paul, we're probably keeping you up beyond your beauty sleep time. WS2N, if you're there, what's latest in space? KQRIW on the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. And, Mel was mentioning the lunar eclipse earlier. We did see it there, naturally in the eastern sky last night. It was cloudier earlier on, but that cleared up, and I was able to see that. Not too often. I think the last one here locally was 2004, and if I'm not mistaken, I think it was a cloudy evening as well. But worked out good last night. STS, the space shuttle, it looks like it's going to be delayed for the next flight. They left it out on a launch pad, and it got clobbered by hail. So that was the end of that. Where they're going to really work that thing over. I heard early predictions of April. I thought that was a little premature. I think they're going to have to put another tank on or something. The tank is very damaged from the hail. It's really a mess. So they got some problems with that external tank. As you know, that's the one with the foam that all comes off, which created the disaster for Columbia. But with this thing, they're not going to take any chances, I'm sure, and it's definitely going to be probably a brand new tank by the time they're done. Probably put another tank on, although I haven't heard that. I've heard late assessments could be June, so we'll see what happens. Atlantis is definitely pulled back, and we'll have to see what happens. They got problems because 5 more flights this year. They want to try to get in 5 flights for 2007. Talking to Mel last week about Mel wanted to know how many flights are left for the completion of the International Space Station. So I did make a list for you there, Mel. I was going to get back to you during the week, but that didn't happen. I was getting up too early and wasn't able to make your net at night during the week on 80, Mel. But I did make up a list of what was left, and you have, you got 5 this year, 4 the following year, 4 in 2009, and only 2 in 10. That's as far as the United States goes with the space shuttle. There are 4 other, Russian flights that have to go up there, crew changes and so forth. The automatic transfer vehicle, that's a gigantic cargo, unmanned cargo ship, going to be launched by the European Space Agency. That'll be one of those 4. So, you've got, roughly 19 flights overall to complete the mission. There are some progress ships that have to go up. There's supply ships as well from Russia. So overall, you're looking at, say, 47 missions, assembly missions, and crew change missions. If you add the progress ships, you're up to 60 plus flights to the International Space Station to build this thing. That's quite a bit. But make a long story short, you've got a total of 15 space shuttle missions left to complete that. hopefully one extra space shuttle mission to rebuild the Hubble Space Telescope. I sure hope that goes off probably in a year or two to try to save that thing. One of the flights you got coming up is scheduled for this June, and now if this thing goes off in June, of course, that next flight will be delayed. She's the backup pilot, or was the backup pilot for Krista McCall on the Challenger mission. When that blew up, she's been waiting in the wings all these years, and we'll get a chance this June to finally get into space and make some transmissions from space and really complete what they started, the Teacher in Space program with Krista McCullough. So that's pretty much it for NASDAQ. Plenty of flights left, plenty of nodes to install. There's one node up there. There's two more nodes eventually to be put up. A node is connecting block for the International Space Station where they attach other components. You've got the Columbus module by the European Space Station to be put on, the Kaibo module by Japan, it will be brought up by 2010. So, and plenty of truss sections left as well, a couple of them, with more solar arrays and various, they call them modules, logistic modules, storage racks attached to the space station. When a shell goes up, they unload things, they put things back into it, and it comes back in the cargo bay. You know, it's roughly half the size of a school bus, you know, loaded with stuff going up and going back. They call it the logistics module. Plenty of work to be done. Should be interesting. And you should have maybe a 15, 20-year lifespan after that for the whole International Space Station. So there you go, Mal. That was a question from last week. Back to you there, Dick. This is WS2N.
K2YEW.
K2YEW, sounds like Norm's got a question. Go ahead, Norm.
I don't have a question. I just wanted to announce my presence.
Okay. You just joined the TechNet for the second time in your career after all these years. To what do we owe this particular honor tonight, Norm? And I presume your commanding officer might be in the car with you. Go ahead, Norm.
And the boss is here. It's W2ETA. And I took the family out to Manhattan to a restaurant. And we're on the way home to Oceanside.
Very fine. And hello to Etta. And the quick question I've got for you, Paul, was the name of the Soviet space station. Why am I having trouble? It's not called Soyuz. What's it called?
They had two of them. They had the Salyut series, a couple of generations of that, and then they had the Mir. Mir meaning peace in Russian. Back to you.
Mir is the one I was thinking of, and I couldn't think of the name of it. Obvious by the fact that Skylab came down and a great big chunk of metal landed in Australia. Mir came down and almost all of it landed in the Pacific Ocean, thank goodness, but the real point is that whatever we put up will come down. And now the International Space Station, we're putting up 10 times more hardware and mass than we've ever put up before. Of all the discussions you hear about, has anyone ever described how it's all going to come back at the end of life of this particular mission? Has anyone ever discussed, are we going to disassemble it and bring it down small pieces at a time? Are we going to let 10 times as much hardware as has ever been put into an International Space Station before? Are we going to allow it to come back 25 years from now? Does anybody even discuss what end of life looks like? And because all of these zillions of launches and all of these zillions of pounds of stuff we're putting up there is a brand new high in total destructive capability when it comes back. Do they discuss that, Paul? And maybe the answer is not yet. They don't want to. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
When the first mission started to go up in 1998, The Russians first put up the first mission, the Zarya block. Then they made it that with the first node from the brought up by the space shuttle. I remember them first discussing what's going to happen when all these things are going to be put together. And proposals were to start taking it apart. But then they said, well, that would be too much work, and it's unnecessary. When this thing starts to deorbit, this thing's going to break apart in big sections. And that's just what happened to the Mir spacecraft, space station. When that came back, that thing broke up in a lot of pieces. If you see the video on that, you know, you can see dozens of these what look like gigantic meteors coming back from outer space. And they'll try to deorbit it just like the Mir over the Pacific and let it land in the Pacific Ocean, Dick. One big chunk. It sounds ridiculous, but that's the latest plan. It's just too much work to take these things apart, put them back into the space shuttle. You can't push them out into further orbit. That would cost a fortune to push it into an orbit to the sun or something. It's nothing but a future meteorite, Dick, as far as I know. Back to you.
Yeah, hopefully we're going to have some kind of a robot booster-like thing 20 years, 30 years from now, when that object reaches end of life, if it does, if our International Space Station does reach end of life, and that robot booster can then do a deorbit burn to guarantee that it's going to hit the atmosphere over the Pacific Ocean. Unfortunately, what could happen, though, and we almost had that problem, is that the International Space Station was in jeopardy for a couple of years because we grounded the space shuttles because of the Columbia disaster. Therefore, the normal space shuttle didn't take place. Under normal circumstances, each visitation by a shuttle is accompanied by a boosting. In other words, the shuttle will use some of its boosting power to re-orbit the International Space Station at a slightly higher orbit. The orbit of the International Space Station is slowly, continuously decaying. And if you don't give it a boost every so often to boost it back up, some terrible things will eventually happen. For instance, almost every single flight of the space shuttle, one of the things that not many people know about is that they do a burn every single 24 hours to reestablish the orbit it's in. When you put up the space shuttle, you're between a rock and a hard place as to selecting what altitude you put it at. You put it at a low enough altitude and it's going to be touching the top of the atmosphere and decaying very rapidly, up to the bottom edge of the Van Allen belt and cooking your astronauts. Now, in the case of the International Space Station, you've got a lot more mass of hardware around the astronauts that gives them a lot more protection. Therefore, you can fly at a higher altitude and hit more of the lower edge of the Van Allen belt. But the space shuttle, in general, doesn't do that. The space shuttle flies in general at a considerably lower altitude. Space station, I think, is at something like 220 nautical miles, and I think the shuttle typically flies at numbers like 145 nautical miles, quite a bit lower. And therefore, it's touching the atmosphere and has to make a burn every single day to reestablish the orbit. So it gives you a little bit of a feeling for what's going on. To send something that's on the International Space Station away to what you and I would consider a junkyard is essentially out of the question. If you could send it to an orbit that's higher than synchronous orbit, higher than the orbit of the synchronous satellites, yes, it will slowly spiral outward. But to get it up to that altitude, which is 6 Earth radii, that's 24,000 miles roughly, 22,300, something like that, might do that. You can talk about sending it toward the sun, but that's even considerably more difficult than just sending it into a geosynchronous orbit or higher, 6 Earth radii. Tremendous. We live in the bottom of a very deep gravity well, and that gravity is created by this very massive object called Earth. And to climb out of that gravity well, like a Cassini spacecraft does, requires a small spacecraft and a tremendous boosting power and flybys of other planets and whatever to get out to where you want it to go. The New Horizons, for instance, is flying by Jupiter, I think, as we speak, using it as a gravity boost to try to get out to Pluto. So to go out to get away from the Earth is a very difficult process. It requires a lot of energy. So to take something that's extremely massive, in fact, you probably know better than I do, Paul, what's the approximate mass total in pounds, kilograms, or whatever, of the International Space Station now, and what's your guess as to what the total mass of the International Space Station will be when the construction is... What kind of masses are we talking about here, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I think the completion's 100 million pounds. It's roughly five times the weight of the shuttle. So it's like taking five shuttles or five 727s up into space. You know, I like to think of it like that, and putting it into orbit. And orbital speed is, 5 miles a second. So to get away from Earth, if you wanted to send it to the sun, for instance, you have to go up to seven miles a second. So, you know, you're going from 17,000 to 25,000 miles an hour. You know, you're looking at roughly a 7,000 mile per hour change in speed. So it would be like, well, how much energy could you imagine? How much weight of energy or, you know, it would take to move five? So, and now you've got to accelerate them, say, 7,000 miles an hour, you know, or roughly 7 miles, or, you know, two miles a second more. You know, it's a tremendous amount of fuel, and you know, it would probably take you maybe 20 missions to bring the fuel up just to attach it to a space station like that. So the cost would be phenomenal, Dick, to blast it out of Earth orbit. So yeah, it's going to be future junk. Someday you'll be sitting there watching your TV, on your high definition TV somewhere, and you're going to watch these pieces come flying out of space. Some news reporter standing over the on some island somewhere in Fiji reporting the destruction of the International Space Station. Hopefully it'll have something else up by then. You know, that's my wish. You know, you'd hate to have a permanent manned space station. But, you know, but they've had it manned since another 15, 20 years down the road. So you're looking at maybe 30-year permanent occupation in space, you know, suddenly come to an end. I don't know. They're going to have to think of a future space station. Maybe one with gravity in the future, Dick. You know, a spinning one. Back to you, Dick.
I want you to run that by again. You said 100 million pounds. Is that the current weight or the future weight when it's completed? But 100 million pounds, if that's, even if it's just a rounded off number, if it's close, that's 50,000 tons, 50 kilotons of hardware, currently moving 17,500 miles an hour at 220 nautical mile altitude. Run that by again. Is that a real number of the final construction, 100 million?
Yes, Dick, that's it. Yeah, I think about like a couple of missions ago when they brought up the P3, P4 truss section. I think that was pretty heavy. That was like 30 tons or so of hardware attached just for one mission. You know, this is what goes on. So I was talking about how many flights have gone up. Shuttle missions are, you got, 15 left, another 20 that have been up there, 35 missions, you know, times all those tonnages, you know, plus what the Russians have launched up there, they're big sections, and they have a more powerful boost to unmanned. You know, when they launch something up, it's unmanned. When they put their living quarters up there, and you know, you add up all this, and over all these missions, and yeah, you're going to get up to that 100 million. 250,000 pounds, I think they always say 250,000, a quarter of a million. So this is, you know, roughly five times. You take five shovels and put them up there, and that's what it's like. Back to you, Dick.
And what's the approximate estimated total cost? Have you seen a number on that one, Paul? How many dollars are we talking about here? I know it's a multi-nation effort with a lot of other nations contributing hardware and dollars, but what's the approximate dollars altogether if it was in American dollars, if you happen to know?
Initial cost, I remember they said it was going to cost like $30 billion. I think they're up to $100 billion. I'll have to check on the internet. You know, I'm sure you can find that in 2 seconds. But that's what comes to mind. Yeah, you've got a consortium of 16 nations involved with this thing. And there's a trade-off, you know. We launch pretty much everything. The Russians launch everything up there. Eventually, European Space Agency will be launching from French Kourou. Then you're going to have a station. You're going to have... Russia's actually made a deal to also launch from French Guiana, Kourou, in South America. So they're building down there now. So you're going to have all these countries, you know, going to the International Space Station. The 16 that are involved get a chance to fly their hardware up. Italy gets to send up the logistics modules that they have in the back that they built. European Space Agency is going to send up their automatic transfer vehicle. That's a gigantic thing. That's going to hold like six times the amount of stuff, the Progress cargo ship that the Russians send up. That's going up this year. They're all involved, and I think collectively, I think $100 billion rings a bell, but you know, we'll have to check on the internet. I might be off on that. Back to you.
It sounds like the right order of magnitude, and I'll show you why. 100 million pounds of hardware, $100 billion is roughly $1,000 a pound. That's a bargain. In the old days, a rough estimate used to be it takes $5,000 to launch 1 pound of hardware into orbit. It used to be $5,000 a pound. And you're describing a International Space Station where we're getting a bargain. We're getting it cheaper because we're buying it in quantity. We're only paying $1,000 a pound to get it into orbit. 100 million pounds, $100 billion. $1,000 a pound. That's a bargain. Whoa. These are big numbers by my standards. That's a lot of mass. That's a tremendous amount of kinetic energy. It's all coming back someday. And thank goodness it's 16 nations and not just one nation, because it's a significant number of dollars. I mean, the biggest thing that I know of in the past that anyone ever bought was either the B-1B 100 airplanes, bombers, or the B-2 bombers. These were, you know, $35 billion type programs. The Apollo program was something around $33 billion, or the whole Apollo program that put man on the moon and brought him back. Nice big numbers. But those guys in Brooklyn, they don't even flinch when they hear numbers like that. Right, Mel? I bet you some of the email you get, I know you've got a couple of emails we should be covering, so let's go do that right now. And some of those guys can make a financial contribution here, and they got the big pockets, the deep pockets, and so there are a significant number of people, believe it or not, who are so in favor of what NASA does that they will write them a check and say, please keep doing it. Here's the money. They got a significant number of private donors that do that. I'm awful glad that it happens. K2KEY, K2IIW on the tech mat.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. I want to thank Paul also for the information. I was curious how much, you know, it was going to take to finally complete this job. Quite a massive job, to say the least. And what about, you know, we don't hear anything anymore about the Hubble. Where or what is going to be transpired with the repair of the Hubble, or is that off the table, Dick? Over.
I think it's on the table, isn't it, Paul? I believe there's an official mission now to repair the Hubble approximately 2 years from now, is it? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, roughly 2 years. they're never going to let that thing go. I think even after the shuttles are gone, they're going to they're going to figure out a way to use the crew crew transfer vehicle, the new rocket to go up there. I think they're going to keep this thing up there, never bring it down. It's too valuable.
Yeah, there's a significant number of Hubble huggers. I mean, arguably that NASA has ever created, bar none. I mean, internationally, that thing has just done things that are just out of this world, literally. You take a look at that deep field photograph and the ultra deep field photograph that Hubble did. That's a mind blower. I mean, to aim the Hubble Space Telescope into a completely blank, dark chunk of sky alongside of the Big Dipper, where you think nothing is there, and you take a 1 million second time-lapse photograph, you integrate for that long, and you look at the photograph, and you see 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before, and the average galaxy contains between 10 and 100 billion stars. That's one galaxy, and you find 2,600 galaxies you've never seen before in a chunk of space that you thought was empty. You take a photograph like that with Hubble, and if that doesn't blow your mind and say, hey, there's a lot more to know here, and that machine's got the ability to give you the raw data by which you're going to find some of that out, I'd like to believe we're never going to abandon that thing. We may build one bigger. We may replace it with something that's bigger and better and further out and stronger and more sensitive and wider in bandwidth and so on. But until there is a replacement for that thing in orbit, it is my belief we will not abandon it. The worst that's going to happen is there's going to be gyros that go dead and power supplies that go dead, and it's going to be a 6-month period of time in which it's running in a crippled manner. That's happened before. And that may happen again before the next mission for repair is done. But there's a darn many people who want that thing. If we have to fire whoever is our current NASA administrator and put a new one in place in order to get that thing repaired, that is what will take place, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Case, this is K2KEY, sounds great. That's a, like you say, it's a very valuable piece of equipment up there, and it's showing us things that we never contemplated seeing. So hopefully that it will be repaired. I assume they will most likely have to start working on the equipment to repair it fairly soon. Time is running out with it. Whether or not they're going to leave it, you know, like you say, in a crippled manner for a period of time, that I wonder, you know, if it wouldn't be a place that would, you know, make it very hard to repair. But are they planning ever to replace it with a better piece of equipment, in other words, more advanced telescope of some sort? Is there any plans of that in the future, Dick, over?
Not a plan, but three different plans. And one of them is called the OWL, Overwhelmingly Large Telescope, OWL. And there's another one, extremely large. There's two or three plans for a much bigger telescope in orbit. And also there's much bigger ones being built on Earth as we speak. So I think everyone realizes that telescopes that cover further into the infrared, further into the ultraviolet, further into the X-ray, larger in light gathering power, higher in altitude, more sensitive detectors, more steady servo mechanisms for aiming. There's a whole series of at least two or three. I'm going to turn it over to Paul. I bet you, Paul, you can name about two or three future space telescopes, which in theory are going to start off where Hubble is and go considerably beyond.
I know they had the terrestrial planet finder. That's been delayed. Cost overruns. Not enough money in the whole NASA budget to do all this stuff. International Space Station is eating up the big part of the budget, with keeping the space shuttle running. So I expect that to come back online. And then you mentioned the OWL, and the third would be the James Webb telescope that would be put in, well, 1 million miles away from Earth. It would be a Lagrange point. That's kind of like the Chandra telescope. That's not serviceable either by a shuttle because of its highly elliptical orbit. What does that go? I think 80,000 miles out at apogee. This thing won't, forget it. It'll be just sitting out there a million miles away, never to be reached again. But that will have incredible sensitivity. Similar blast to what you see in the Keck telescope, these segmented pieces which will unfold and be, you know, work as one with lasers and all sorts of detectors to make sure that the mirrors are all aligned correctly. So it'll be, you know, like three times bigger area-wise than the actually three times bigger diameter-wise than the Hubble Space Telescope when the James Webb scope comes online. It's named after one of the earliest administrators of the program who was very instrumental in putting NASA on the right direction in the early years, in the early 1960s, to eventually get people to the moon. He was down at Congress talking and really into science, and he really pushed the envelope to get things going in the right direction. So they named this telescope the James Webb Telescope. After him, back to you, Dick, WS-20.
As you can see, Mel, Americans for sure, and Europeans also, certainly the European Space Agency and Japanese Space Agency, all contain people who just love big telescopes. Wider frequencies, wider angles of view, higher gains, bigger mirrors, more sensitive detectors, and so on. There's always going to be telescopes, more and more of them, both on Earth and in orbit, and further out in orbit, and in Lagrange points, and so on. It's the best way we can find out what's going on. And this universe, as they study it, as I see it, Mel, I subscribe to Scientific American and a few other magazines, and you read these articles about what they're discovering, and it's just getting stranger and stranger. The fact that all the material out at the perimeter of our observable universe, we were positive it would be slowing down, and eventually Big Bang would be followed by Big Crunch. So they very carefully, by two or three different techniques, measure how fast the stuff at the perimeter is slowing down to find out when it's going to stop and start coming back. And the stuff out there ain't slowing down, it's speeding up. Everywhere at the perimeter, stuff is moving away from us at a velocity that is increasing. And they're having the vaguest idea what's causing that. They call it dark energy. They've given it a name, dark energy. That's like the word virus. You don't know what it is, but you gave it a name. It's called dark energy. I keep going to these astronomy meetings, and they say, do you realize that you guys five times in a row have been humbled, where the Earth is not the center of the universe, the sun is not the center of the universe, our galaxy is not the center of the universe, our galaxy group is not the center of the universe, and the observable universe is probably not the only one. So we're about to be humbled for the sixth time and find out there are multiverses, multiple universes. There wasn't just one Big Bang. There's a zillion Big Bangs. And so that those other universes out there beyond our observable universe, they've got gravity. And the stuff that's out at our perimeter is sucking it over the hill into their universe. That's my strong belief. It's just a matter of time before we find out once again that the sixth humbling for mankind is about to happen, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I guess, like you say, it's endless. You know, you mentioned a folding telescope or something that's going to unfold. Exactly what does that mean? And, scale, in other words, could I build some kind of a telescope that could unfold, Dick? I just not quite understanding. Is this a mirror that actually can be unfolded? Is that what you're trying to say? Over.
Okay, the biggest piece of glass that mankind has ever created is the 200-inch mirror at Mount Palomar, which I personally have gone and seen with my own eyes. I didn't touch it. I touched a model of it that was outside of the real telescope housing at Mount Palomar. And that particular piece of glass, the best thing in the world, called the Corning Glass Works, had to cast the thing twice because the first one cracked, and it took them a couple of years just to cool the darn thing off. You can't build a piece of glass bigger than 200 inches. Therefore, if you want a bigger mirror, you're going to build it in sections. So whether you make those sections square, hexagonal, or whatever, they do build them in hexagonal sections. The biggest telescope right now built in hexagonal sections that we all know about is the Keck telescope in Hawaii, K-E-C-K. You look that up on the internet and you'll find lots of information. It's made out of, I think it's 32 individual hexagonal pieces. And so those 32 hexagonal pieces, you carefully mount them onto a very steady frame. You have motors in the three corners that can slowly crank each one of those pieces forward and aft in each one of the three corners. You have a laser interferometer at the focal point looking at each of those pieces of 32 pieces of glass and saying, hey, this one's a little bit tilted to the left, and this one's a little bit low, and this one's a little bit high, and you send the orders to those motors to correct. And once you've got a correctable 32-section mirror, you can now make it as accurate as you like. Even if your frame is sagging with gravity and heating up with temperature and it's got snow load and wind load and whatever, you can correct for it. That's exactly what we've done with the world's largest fully steerable radio telescope, the very large, what is it now called, the Green Bank Telescope, the GBA. It's a 100 meter diameter telescope, which I've seen under construction at Green Bank, West Virginia, National Radio Astronomy Observatory. That one is made out of 2,000 panels that are individually tunable. So when it comes to really big aperture telescopes, whether it be optical, radio astronomy, or whatever, the current technique, because you can't build one chunk that's big, you build it in sections, you mount it on a very steady frame that's movable, and you have motors in the corners of each individual piece, which you tune. You have a bunch of commands to each of those motors. And by laser interferometry, you measure the error today at this instant of time, and you correct for it. And if you've done a good enough job of feeding those pieces together correctly, tight enough, those 2,000 pieces in Green Bank act like one single piece, 100 meters in diameter, 300 and some odd feet in diameter radio telescope. The biggest thing we've got that's fully steerable. The only thing that's larger is the Arecibo 1,000-footer. But it's not fully steerable. The one in Green Bank, the great big telescope, is fully steerable. And that's the way you do it. Individual sections. You have no choice when you get this big, because nobody can build a bigger piece of glass than 200 inches in diameter. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, very good. This is K2KEY. And they mean they can want to ship a thing like this into space and assemble it. Good grief. My God. That sounds like a big engineering job. So in other words, they'll put together this huge mirror in pieces in space. Is that what the plan is, over?
On these space telescopes, I believe the plan is to design it in such a way that the pieces all fold together very neatly for transport, and then it deploys itself. It unfolds itself in space and reestablishes the right shape. I think that's the proposal. Let me check with Paul on that one. WS2N, have you seen a confirmation on that, Paul? K2RIW?
You have it right, Dick. Exactly right. No people will be involved in that construction once it's in orbit. That's it. It'll unfold all by itself. Everything will be all set up. Your lasers will be come on to do exactly what you said before, Dick. Your actuators will be able to move the mirrors. It's all got to work, and it's all got to work right. Like I said, it's not going to be serviceable. So, completely unmanned. Back to you, Dick.
Now, I'm going to make a guess, Paul, that because the deployment procedure for a really massive telescope, whether it be optical, radio, whatever, and you got individual hexagonal, usually shaped pieces that have to unfurl, properly deploy themselves, and establish that it's in proper working order, it is my guess that the sequence is that you launch this into a parking orbit close to the Earth, you do the deployment procedure, you look at the servos, you look at the telemetry system, and you say, aha, it properly deployed, and it's all working. Now take your own sweet time, boosting it into the higher orbit, into the location where you want it. And the advantage of doing it that way is if there's a failure in the deployment. See, the roughest part of the mission is to get from the Earth's surface through that rough atmosphere into the parking orbit. That's the dangerous part of the mission. And so after it's been through the dangerous part, I am guessing you deploy 98% of it in parking orbit, confirm that it's all working, then you slowly boost it into the higher orbit. That's a much safer way to go, because if you find a failure there, you have the opportunity to go up to that parking orbit with a shuttle and kick the side of it, so to speak, with the astronaut foot to make it work right. You kick the tires, so to speak, and you fix the problem before you launch it. I wonder if they've said things along those lines to your knowledge, Paul. WS2N, go right ahead.
No, it's supposed to be deployed after it gets to its million mile orbit. It's not really going to be orbiting. It'll be sitting out there in the Lagrange point. What's going to happen, Dick? They're going to launch this thing on a highly elliptical orbit, similar to what they do with Chandra Chandra's missions. They launch highly elliptical, and then they keep getting even higher. And they'll bring it, they'll orbit the Earth until eventually it gets out to its point. You know, it's better to do it that way. To put it in a circular orbit and then try to get it out to this highly elliptical orbit, I think it would probably be too expensive. Cut down on the fuel. My guess is they're going to probably do it, when it finally gets to its final location. You know, once this thing is all unfurled and all, I don't know, to have the booster come on after that. I guess you could do that, Dick. I can't really say for sure. You might be right, doable. I just can't just see this gigantic mirror unfurled and then put pressure behind it to put it into orbit after that. You know, it's got to accelerate maybe a couple of thousand miles. I guess you could do it slowly. I guess it's doable. Back to you, Dick.
You've got a good point, though, Paul, and that is, if you want the maximum efficiency out of a rocket motor, you must run it at maximum thrust. That's how you get the highest specific impulse out of the fuel that's available. So the word gently boosting into orbit, you could sort of do that if you have a whole lot of tiny little motors and you use them one at a time. But that's a lot of duplication of effort of individual motors and fuel chunks and whatever. So I guess you've got to design something that you believe is extremely robust and reliable in a deployment procedure. Because I guess the right way to do it is to use maximum thrust of the engine, get it out to where you really want it, the Lagrange point, a million miles away, away from the sun, from the Earth, a million miles up higher, which is beyond the orbit of the moon, by the way, by 4 to 1. And you put it out there and then deploy it. And boy, you better deploy correctly. Otherwise, 400 megabucks just went down the tube. So you have no choice, because the amount of boost power required to full thrust out of the engine and to take a huge mirror that you've deployed in parking orbit and make it strong enough to survive full thrust of the engine. I wouldn't say it's undoable, but it sounds like it's a tough way to go. Sounds to me like you'd be developing a frame for holding all those pieces of the mirror a hell of a lot stronger than you need for the rest of the mission. Tough engineering problem. But the guys in the New York City area, they can do that, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, yeah, get started tomorrow morning. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I appreciate these big engineering projects, because no doubt that every time somebody says, no, it can't be done, well, mankind, we figure a way of doing it. At that program last week on, with a repeat, I've seen it a number of times about the design and building of the Brooklyn Bridge, and what a project that was, to do it in the horse and buggy days, and how he did it. That basically, pencil, paper, and slide rule, just so... To achieve these huge engineering feats, I think given the time and the and man's determination, I'm sure it can be done. Okay, I can say I got some emails. A number of emails, I guess, was the questioning when we were talking a few weeks ago about connecting one transmission line to another and, determining the true VSWR in that particular situation. So I got a number of requests that we did this with the Smith chart, but they asked me if I'd repeat it. So if you feel that we have the time for it, Dick, I'll just run through one more time on this particular use of the Smith chart. K2RIW in the TechNet, this is K2KEY.
Four words of introduction of how I solve that problem, because I run into that problem two or three times per week in what I do as an occupation. As an occupation, I'm designing antennas day in and day out, and the customer, my consultant client, always wants more gain, narrower beamwidth, smaller antenna, squeezed into a smaller package. That's what he always wants. And I've got to keep teaching them the laws of physics as to what's possible. I mean, lots of people like Harold Wheeler have written articles on electrically small antenna, which tell you how far you can push it. And so when it comes to mixing transmission lines, and I've done it, the way I do it is to first realize that the antenna you start off with probably has a pretty wild impedance, fairly high standing wave ratio value. So you can put a dot somewhere on the Smith chart as to what is the antenna you've got, and you've got to feed power into that mother, that puppy, mismatch to that dot on the Smith chart. That's essentially what Mel has been teaching us. And chapter 18, I think it is, of the ARRO antenna book does a pretty good job of teaching you how to do that. And after you've gone through a certain length of your transmission line, and you've made near end or somewhere in between, is your choice. And there's pros and cons of each of those. And once you end with transmission line number one, you've got a brand new place on the Smith chart where you now are. Whether you start off with a little black box that's called antenna and you impedance match it, or you use antenna plus feed line, and the Smith chart tells you what you're going to get on the other end of that feed line, that transmission line, and that brings you to a new dot on the Smith chart. And you can make believe that's the starting position. You now put a great big black box around that antenna plus that transmission line. That's a brand new dot, and now you solve that problem. So if you can do it once, to do it again is 98% of the same process, step and repeat. That's the way I do it, as two separate problems. I will admit that if you're smart enough, there's a way you can do it all in one swell swoop on the Smith chart, where you start off with the antenna, transmission line number one, transmission line number two, two different impedances and so on of the transmission lines. And it's a little bit easier to lose yourself that way, but if you're smart enough, you can do it all on one sheet of paper. I do it on two separate sheets. And that way I can check each individual result and decide if I like it and do some checks and balances to see if it makes sense. That's my way of doing it. Let's see how Mel does it. K2KEY, go right ahead with your lecture at K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, I did want to, I simplified it all down from a question that, or I should say, a discussion one time on similar to what you just mentioned, Dick. So I actually did one we had in one of our tutelages. So basically, people have asked me to repeat this, so I will repeat it. I'll go slow, and that's basically, they all said that there's too many jumps. They tried to understand it, the ARRL manual and a number of places. They said there aren't any places where they find step-by-step. They said too much for granted that you understand, and it becomes too confusing. Like you say, it can become confusing sometimes. Doing it on two different sheets of paper can help. This has to be done on one sheet of paper, and I'll go fairly slow again. All right, let's just set up the situation here. We have an antenna, and the antenna comes with a piece of transmission line. This is the way it's shipped, and in this particular case, the transmission line was not long enough to reach the shack. So just to use the antenna in a pinch, the only thing that was available was a piece of 72 ohm line, and they wanted to connect it to this existing line, this 50 ohm line, by the way, that comes with the antenna. So, okay, this is basically, we're going to ask the question, what is the true VSWR on the 72 line? That's the piece that winds up in the shack connected to the rig. So now, there were some measurements that were made, and if you have your Smith chart out, your compass ready, your straight edge, we can begin. I'll give everybody a couple of seconds just to get everything set up, and then I'll more or less go through it. And of course, what you could do, you could always substitute your own values in different transmission line impedances and things, and basically do it the same way. All right, now with your Smith chart, now I'll give you basically what the antenna is like. The antenna reads at the antenna, a test is made, and the antenna reads 100 resistance plus J0, no reactance. Again, the transmission line that's connected at this point is a 50 ohm line, comes with the antenna, and it's specified to be 0.15 wavelength long. That's what it comes with the antenna. That's the specification on the antenna. Transmission line, the 50 ohm line, at 0.15 wavelength long. Now, it's not long enough, this transmission line, to reach the shack in this case. So, in a pinch, just so we can get this thing on the air, we connect a piece of 72 ohm line, just happen to have a round, that reaches the shack. And the question was, what is the VSWR on the 72 ohm line? Okay? So now, how do we do this? Okay, first thing we're going to do, we take the reading that we got on the antenna, 100 plus J0, and we call it, normalize it. We divide it by 50, which gives us 2 plus J0. Now let's plot that on the chart, go along the axes to the right of the 1.0, and find 2.0, put a dot there, we'll call that dot, that point Z, like for Zulu, Z. Now if we continue through, we'll see that towards the generator, now we're going towards, remember the rig, that's all called towards the generator, you'll see it on the edge of the chart, and you'll notice that if we read that 2.5 wavelength, that's right on the edge of the axis is extended, right through the edge of the chart. Let's call that point A, right there for alpha. Now, they told us that the transmission line was 0.15 wavelengths long. So let's add that to our 0.25 that we just found at point A. And that will give us 0.40 towards the generator. Go around the ring. We see 0.40. At that point, I want you to take the straight edge, draw a line from 1.0, that's the center of the chart, right straight down through 0.40, and at that point, we'll mark that point.
Yeah, one quick question I've got, Mel, and that is the 70 ohm line that comes into the shack, do we know the length it's going to be? I think you told me the 50 ohm line is 0.15 wavelength long. And if you told me I've forgotten, what's the length of the 70-ohm line that then comes into the shack?
No, we don't know that. We're not really interested in that. We just want to know what the VSWR winds up at. That was not given. We just want to determine what the VSWR is, if it's within reason to be used on the rig, Dick, over.
Beautiful. Okay. You're going to solve it with a Smith chart, and I'm going to solve it with a set of an equations. And we're going to compare the answer. It should be fun. Please proceed.
Okay, very good. So now we have this point B, which is at the 0.40. Take our compass now. Put the pin of the compass on the center of the chart, 1.0. Open up the compass to the point Z, the point Zulu, that was at the 2.0 on the chart. And we're going to swing an arc that is going to intersect that line at B. You know, just make a short arc down, it's below the line, a short arc, and it's going to intersect line B. Now, at that point, we're going to read that point. We'll call that point X for X-ray, by the way. And we'll just read that point. And you'll see it's approximately, we look at the resistance, it's approximately 0.68 minus, because it's below the line, below the axis. So we'll call that minus J, 0.48. Just write that down, and you can determine exactly that point, you know, the reading exactly, you know, look at it with a magnifying glass or whatever, but we'll call that point X. That'll be close enough. I plotted it here, so it's point, it'll come out to 0.68 minus J, 0.48. Okay, now, if we take that point that we just found, that 0.68 minus J, 0.48, and we multiply it by 50, we'll find we have 34 ohms resistive minus 24 ohms reactive. That is through the 50 ohm cable. However, we've got a 72 ohm cable connected to that. So let's take that same reading, that 34 ohms minus 24, and normalize it to the 72 ohm line. And how do we do that? Just the way we did it, normalized it to the 50. We divide 72 into 34 minus 24. And we'll get 0.47 minus J, 0.33 in this case. So now if we look for this point on the Smith chart, again, 0.33. We find that on the Smith chart here. And we'll put a little dot there. We'll call that point Y for yesterday. Now, put the pencil point on point Y, and we swing a 360-degree circle all around. In other words, radius. Y is 1.0. Put the compass on point Y. Make that circle all around. Now, if you'll notice down below the bottom of the Smith chart to the left of the side, you see it says SWR. Now, let us drop a parallel line from the edge of the circle we just drew. That's the one sub where it says SWR. And you'll notice that we go right through 2.5. So now we know that our SWR on our 72 line is 2.5 to 1. You can substitute any kind of range in here, but it'll basically work out always the same way. So, KEY.
Hey, your push-to-talk button was giving you a little bit of dropouts there, Mel, but we were getting 95% of it. And what you did graphically, you got good accuracy. By exact calculations, after your 0.15 wavelength of 50 ohm line, you came up with 34 ohms minus J, 24. And I came up with 33.75 minus 24.000. So very, very close. And then when you connect that to a 72 ohm line, I got 2.43 to 1 Vizwar. I think you had 2.4. Darn close. So in other words, let's see, you are 3% higher than me. Darn close. K2KEY, K2LIW, we agree.
Okay, so I figured, is this, would you say, a simple enough method for determining, or do you have a better way of using the Smith chart in this particular example, Dick? I try to break it down so that it be, you know, the most straightforward way of using the Smith chart for this procedure. Is there any other way that you can think of would be either a simpler way or another method of applying the same situation over?
there's a zillion ways of using the Smith chart. And you're really asking me, is yours the simplest way? And I think it's darn close to the simplest. It's the way that I do it as a backup when I want to do it graphic. With this